Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and this is a super big treat because in studio we have the one and only...
Ann Hornaday, Chief Film Critic from the Washington Post.
And also the new co-host of the podcast, Plug It.
This is true, At the Movies with Arch and Ann.
Yes.
Download every Friday, please. We're having a very good time with Mark Stern, our friend from the Tony Kornheiser Show. We have a ball. We chop it up. We talk about movies. We talk about pop culture. We talk about what's been in the news that week. I basically sit and listen to Arch because he's the font of all wisdom in this town, as we both know. So I defer to him in all things, but we really do have a good time.
Absolutely. Who doesn't love Arch Campbell?
I know.
But we're here to talk about your new book, Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies.
Yes.
And I got to say, I knocked it out during my beach week. It was a little page turner for a movie guy like me. I loved it. It was catnip.
I'm flattered. I don't think there's much in there that you don't already know, Jason.
You're being too modest, but I definitely learned a few things, but I was more interested which examples you'd use for each thing. No, it was fascinating. But it's such a great book because it really is a guide to, you know, let's say your average Joe moviegoer walks into the theater, they see the movie and they come out, but then they might read a review and say, wait a minute, I didn't notice that, or why did she take a different, you know, approach than
exactly.
I did? So is that sort of the gist of why you wanted to write it?
Yeah, it was really because, I mean, we live in an age of ubiquitous criticism. Everyone really is a critic now, because if they're not commenting on a blog or they're going on to IMDb or Rotten Tomatoes to leave their own user reviews, they're tweeting or they're Facebooking or Instagramming with their friends. There are just so many ways for people to make their opinions known. So I thought it would be maybe useful for people who are kind of, you know, maybe casual to interested movie fans who just are interested in how a professional approaches her job. And especially I feel like I can relate because I didn't come at this as a movie geek. I mean, I didn't go to film school. I really kind of learned on the job. So I kind of feel like I'm, you know, maybe some of what I've learned along the way could be useful for people who just want to think about films a little more critically.
Oh, it's super helpful. You mentioned just a second ago about how you came at it from a little bit of a different way. How did you actually fall into this lovely world of film
criticism? I fell into a big vat of whipped cream. I did. I got so lucky. But I started as just a general freelancer. You know, I mean, I moved to New York after graduating from college. I didn't major in film or even in English in college. I majored in government. If anything, I thought I'd be in D.C. one day working at the State Department or something.
Right.
But instead, I went to New York to try to make it as a writer. And I got a magazine job at Ms. Magazine, and I stayed there for a few years, but then really almost very, very early went freelance. And so I started to write about movies and filmmakers as a freelancer, but along with a bunch of other different subjects. And so my specializing in film was very gradual, and it had more to do with who I was writing for, because I started by writing for things like Premiere and Us Magazine, and then eventually that led to the New York Times Arts and Leisure section, and so that really gave me more visibility as a quote-unquote film writer.
Right.
And it was basically on the strength of my work for the Times that I was hired at the Austin American Statesman to be a critic, and that was my first job.
Do you remember
your
first review for the Times?
Oh, I remember it like it was yesterday because it was of the movie To Die For.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
That wonderful, I think it was, it would have been 1995.
Wow.
Gus Van Sant directing, Nicole Kidman in one of her all-time best performances. She had already done things like Dead Calm, which she was also brilliant in. But I mean, I think this was really a breakout for her.
Yeah.
And it took her into just such daring directions. And it was just a knockout of a film on all levels. And I'll never forget going into the newsroom. And I was so excited to tell people about this great movie. And I was so happy it was my first review. And then I sit down and literally that cliched scene. I look at the screen. The words won't come.
The blinking
How
cursor.
How do I begin? Exactly. How, you know, now what, you know?
Yeah.
So it was, yeah, I'll never forget that. It was a really challenging moment.
Wow. So from there, you said you moved where?
So then I stayed in Austin for a couple of years and then came to the Baltimore Sun. And I still live in Baltimore and worked there for very happy years. I mean, that was a wonderful era at the Baltimore Sun because they were very interested in literary journalism, narrative journalism, and that it did extend to reviewing. I mean, they loved to take risks. They encouraged me to really develop a strong voice.
Did you know Mike Sfrego up there?
Well, no, because when I came, I actually ended up, I left The Sun in order to write a book, which never came to fruition. And then Mike took my place there.
I see.
Which was a thrill. I mean, I was so flattered and honored that he would be the person to take my place. I mean, if anything, I mean, I cannot fill his shoes. So
right.
The thought of him, I mean, I won't even use the term filling shoes because
He's the best.
He is the best. I mean, he is one of the finest film critics in America. They were so lucky to have him. I'm so sorry. As a Baltimorean, I'm sorry that they lost him.
What was that book? So now you've written a new book, but what was the book you left
I know,
for?
That one was a passion project. I wanted to write a book. Right before I left The Sun, I had done a big article on one of my all-time favorite movies called Sweet Smell of Success.
Oh, my God. You,
right?
Kendrick. Oh,
we
my
all
God.
Love it.
Oh, my God. The Alexander cats in the bags and the bags in the river.
Some of the best lines. It was written by Cliff Odets, directed by Alexander McKendrick, Burt Lancaster, Tony Curtis, New York, black and white, James Wong House, cinematographer. Oh, I mean, it's just got, it fires on every cylinder. It is tough, mean, cynical, and also just sort of hilariously funny with these florid lines that Odets wrote.
Cookie full of arsenic.
You're a cookie full of arsenic. Yeah, the cat's in the bag. I mean, it just goes on and on. It's probably one of the most quoted movies ever. And it's a real, you know, it was a very seminal movie for people like James Mangold. I mean, he's a huge fan of that movie. You can see its influences in, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson put a beautiful little quote from it into Boogie Nights. I mean, you can see little quotes from it in lots of people's work. I think Soderbergh's probably a big fan. Yeah. So I wanted to write about it. I wanted to write about the making of and then also its influence.
Oh, wow.
And I had done all these, you know, it was Ernie Lehman who wrote the story that the movie was based on and also co-wrote the script with Odets. He was still living.
Right.
So I interviewed him. And I interviewed everybody who was still alive, including Tony Curtis, who, true story, he was living in Las Vegas. I did a phone interview with him. And while we were talking, his other phone rang. And he said, just a minute, darling. I mean, he had the accent and everything.
Yeah.
He said, just a minute, and went and answered it. And then I could hear what he was saying. He was arranging for dinner with a friend. And he said, all right, darling, you know, I'll see you later. The cat's in the bag and the bag's in the river. And he comes back. And I said, was that for my benefit? And he said, oh, no, I end every conversation that way. It's my favorite line in the world. And
okay,
that was my kicker. He gave me my... But anyway, so I wanted to write a book, but it was just too niche.
Right.
You know, maybe I should dust it off and try to sell it again.
Bring it back.
Because I do love that movie.
Oh, man. It's beautiful.
Absolutely.
It's one of the great, most gorgeous shots.
One of the best uses of black and white photography. And, you know, another influence was Raging Bull. I mean, if you watch Raging Bull today, wow, you can really see how Scorsese watched Sweet Smell before doing that, because it's just, it's got that same gleaming sort surfaces and that same tough tone too.
Didn't you write in the book the cinematographer painted oil on,
James
on
Wong
the night
Howe,
streets?
Yeah, that's the lore, was that he coated the walls in oil to give him a sheen, you know,
so
in the nightclubs.
Yeah.
It was just amazing.
That's awesome.
It's
well, you and I will tangent on that all day.
Yes,
but,
yes.
Oh, yeah. So you wrote that book, and then how do you get to the Washington Post?
So then that was back in the time when they had a number of different reviewers. They had reviewers for the style section, and then they had reviewers for the weekend section.
Gotcha.
Which was always such an interesting setup. And I think Washingtonians learned to really love that, you know, because they would see what Stephen Hunter thought of something, and then they'd see what Dessen thought of something. And it was just
Yes.
I mean, it was just, it was really neat.
Yeah.
So Rita Kempley took a year off on a fellowship, on a journalism fellowship, and they needed someone to take her place just for a year. And so I was sort of, you know, I had no intention of coming back to film criticism, but I thought, all right, I can do that for a year. It might be fun. And I was working with, you know, people I had worked with before, and I thought it would be a good time. And then when she came back, it was right when they were starting to offer buyouts. And so I think she was in a really great position to be able to capitalize on that. So she ended up moving on, and then they needed someone to take her place, which I had been doing all year. So, I mean, but they still sort of made me audition for the role. But here I am, like 16 years later, and I was never even supposed to stay more than a year. So go figure.
And this city is all the better for it. I mean, every time you come on Fridays with Sean and Hillary in the afternoon, I mean, Hillary was just raving about it. You're a wordsmith.
They honestly... And you're very good at this, too. I mean, you get as good as you elicit, and all of you are incredibly good at your jobs. And you bring out the best in the people that you talk to, so.
All right. Well, anyway, enough about T.O.P., post-love here. So all these years, you've done all these reviews, and now you're imparting the wisdom you've found to other moviegoers and maybe even aspiring critics somewhere out there.
Sure, I'd love it.
In your book, Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies. So let's talk about this.
Okay.
How to watch movies, you kind of break it down in a really helpful way. You go sort of chapter by chapter, but it's, let's say, discipline by discipline. So you start with screenwriting.
Yeah.
And you say a good script keeps the story moving at an engaging, even suspenseful clip, providing just enough information to keep the audience curious, but not hopelessly confused.
Yes.
And I know some of your examples you cite are Chinatown, Groundhog Day.
Absolutely.
You know, what makes a good script, Anne Arnold?
Well, you know, it's that. I think, you know, one way to look at this is just sort of how do you know when something's been well written? I mean, what are the hallmarks of something? And I think it does have that coherence and cohesion to it. And it just like it sets up a world that you immediately buy into and that you are very happy to enter into for a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. And there's not a moment that makes you step back and go, huh? Mm-hmm. Or that doesn't ring true or what? Or that's corny or cliche. And I think one of the hallmarks of a really well-written movie for me now that I've been doing this for a while is that first 10 or 15 minutes. You know, I mean, I wonder if you, yep.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you agree with me that you can kind of tell, you know, you're well-established, you know the world you're in, you pretty much know the characters. I mean, the example I use in the book, which is one of the all-time great opening scenes that does live up to its promise, is The Godfather. You know, that classic
I believe
opening
America.
Where you're meeting all those people and in such a heightened atmosphere of the wedding outside and the office inside. It's just brilliantly, brilliantly written.
It really says all you need to know about the entire movie.
And, it does. It teaches
that line,
you how to watch
it. That's my family, Kay, not me. I mean, that's the whole journey, the tragic fall we're
exactly.
going to see.
And then you see what will that portend. Like, yeah. Will he live that out or will he rue the day? You know, it just sets it up beautifully.
Yeah, and then obviously then we usually get the catalyst around page 10.
Exactly.
And then, you know, we break into two and all that stuff, and screenwriters can talk about forever and ever. But you also mentioned in the book that a lot of screenwriters struggle around, there's that act two slump, I think you call it.
Yeah, because like you had just mentioned, you know, you get the catalyst. There are these formulas for writing screenplays that a lot of young screenwriters have read, and they adhere to them very slavishly. And so I think that, you know, one of the downsides of that is that, I mean, the upside is that people can deliver a polished professional script, but often they bear too much of like, oh, I need to have a catalyst on page 10. Right. And so then it feels very false.
Like cookie
so
cutter,
with second acts, it's like it's very difficult to kind of keep, you know, you have to introduce some kind of a conflict or a setback. And to do that organically and not make it feel like, oh, I need to get a conflict or a setback. I mean, that's very, very tough.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's the kind of thing where, I mean, to me, you know, another hallmark of a really well-written film is you kind of, it's almost in retrospect that you realize how brilliant it is. Because at the time, you shouldn't be aware. You know, you shouldn't be saying, oh, that was a good twist. Or, you know, it's like, it's more looking back thinking, wow, I didn't see, you know, oh, they did plant the seed of that little transformation, you know, in way back in Act One. Like, oh, that is all, it all knits together somehow, but without being obvious.
One way I thought that kind of worked was you cited Groundhog Day, and it's kind of how when the plot structure and theme are kind of all woven in
exactly.
together, whereas like you've cracked the code to what makes Groundhog Day great. And the sentence was, it's Bill Murray's own selfishness and immaturity that keep him in the time loop, which only stop once he's grown up and become a decent human being.
Right.
It's true.
Yes, that's very well put. I mean, and I wish, like, I don't even think I articulated that, but you're absolutely right. When a structure kind of equals the theme, that's something of real beauty, you know?
And then why do you cite Chinatown? I think it's something about that it gives us just enough about Gideon and Noah Cross
exactly.
and his family.
It's that dueling out. It's that kind of classic mystery thriller template. Just the way that he's giving you the information, it's just expertly done.
And to your point of how you said you don't realize it as you're there, but by the end you look back only then, I mean, you see that it's all, Robert Town in that case is setting it all up. She's accidentally hitting her head on the car horn or you know what I mean? Stuff that pays off later until the shocking conclusion.
Exactly. But,
It's amazing. It's an amazing script.
It makes you really appreciate. I mean, I think if I've learned anything in the writing of this, I've always believed that films are a director's medium. I still do. But I think I came away from this with a much deeper appreciation of just how important a good script is. Yeah. But when I interviewed Kenneth Lonergan last year about Manchester by the Sea, I said, you know, that was an example to me of great structure. I was like, in doling out, you know, like, because we don't know what's bothering this guy, you know.
Turns out there's a lot bothering him.
It is, but the way that he kind of gets there, it's so incremental and it's so subtextual. And I said, that must have been tough to figure out when. And he's like, no. He said, I wasn't thinking of it structurally at all. It was really coming from the character. Mm-hmm. And I do appreciate that now more. Like if I think of a Chinatown and a Groundhog Day for that matter. I mean, these are all character-driven pieces. And it's all about what would the character do? What, you know, what's believable for that person? Yeah. What's driving them?
One last thing for you about, because we can't pass the script section without talking about the dialogue.
Yes.
And how, I guess, that's where one of the biggest pitfalls is, right, is exposition. What is it? You mentioned Austin Powers about Basil
exposition.
They spoof, but explain what exposition is and why it is such an albatross on so many scripts.
It is, and it's so hard to get around, but it's when a character helpfully provides either a backstory or just information, you know, that the audience needs to know in order to proceed. But it's just when we call it exposition, it's usually in a, as a pejorative, and it means that it's been done very clunkily, and it's and it just sticks out. It slows everything down. It stops the flow. It feels false. It feels like somebody who's giving us information we need to know. Yeah. And so another hallmark of a brilliant screenplay is that you are not aware at all of the exposition, or the exposition isn't done in a speech. It's done visually. You know, it's done in all sorts of other ways, but not by somebody just sitting there saying like, well, don't you remember in 1945 when, you know, when we were both dating the same girl and she left you for me? I mean, that's
no like one talks dead, like that. Yeah.
Nobody does. And even little things bug me, like when somebody ever says, but I made French toast. It's your favorite. It's like, nobody says that because it's implied. If they know each other that well, they don't need to say it's your favorite. Yeah. It just seems so redundant to me. So
now you got me thinking about Five Easy Pieces with the toast and the...
Yeah, right. I know.
All right. Do you have a favorite line other than Cats in the Bag and the Bag in the River? And a piece of dialogue that jumps out at you?
I'll say I was misinformed and Casablanca is one of the all-time greats.
Oh, I came here for the waters.
Yes, yes. And then there's another great one in there where Peter Lorre says, you don't like me very much, do you, Rick? And Rick's like, if I ever thought about you, I guess I wouldn't.
Or if he tells Laszlo, you know, we all try, but you succeed. There's like little ones like that are, you know, everyone knows the famous ones, but yeah, that's great. All right. Let's move on to acting. Are you more of the traditional style, like the Vivien Leigh, or the method style, like Brando? And I mean, I know you write in the book about how they collide in Streetcar.
That's a great tutorial in both those styles, actually.
Maybe explain. Well, let's use that as an example. Explain to our listeners like those two contrasting styles.
It's fascinating. She was trained at the Royal Academy of Arts in London. I mean, she came from a very classical training. She was, of course, married to Laurence Olivier, the embodiment of classical film and theater acting. And she's cast as Blanche DuBois in Streetcar Named Desire, opposite a bunch of method. You know, it was Elia Kazan. Right. He was Mr. Method on the stage. So everybody she was surrounded with, not just Brando, but everybody was method. But Brando, of course, was the granddaddy of the method. And you can see, you know, the discomfort is palpable, which worked for the story and worked for their characters because they're supposed to be uncomfortable around each other. So in a way, it was method, even though she was not working in the method. It was a method exercise, you know, in terms of having the real, because the method is all about sort of drawing on real life experience and your own personal memories. And
so for Blanche, it worked because she's
an outsider. Exactly. But and she, you know, she did beautifully in that film. I mean, she was holding her own the whole way. So I don't really think. I really just think there's all sorts of different techniques and tools for actors to, quote unquote, go there, you know, to find their character and to stay in character and to really go to the, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis, famous for staying in character on and off all the time when he's making
dressed
the movie.
As Abe Lincoln around
exactly.
town.
Please call me Mr. Lincoln, you know, and that's kind of, you know, people kind of make fun. And, but, you know, I just say whatever it takes, man. It's like you can't argue with the results.
Right.
Like he's
Dustin Hoffman will have to inhabit it for a while.
Yeah.
But someone else maybe does it a different way. But whatever gets you there.
Right.
Man.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it's interesting. And but, you know, I think I don't know if you agree as a critic, but I think quantifying a performance is one of the hardest things we do.
Absolutely.
You know, when we describe, well, why does that succeed and why doesn't that? And what's really interesting is when we diverge, you know, with our readers or our listeners, and it's sort of like something might not work for us, but they love it. It's like, who can tell?
Yeah.
It's so subjective, you know, whether or not you really believe somebody in a role. And then in the case of like a movie star, we were talking about this the other day with Arch. He's at the point where he almost can't really watch Woody Harrelson without seeing Woody Harrelson, right? I mean, his persona has it's so big now.
Yeah.
And so then when your persona's big, like if you're an Angelina Jolie or...
Right, you write about that in the book. She can't really escape that sometimes.
You can't. Yeah. I mean, when you're that level. So then the job is to find the right roles that will fuse with that persona so that people can accept both at the same time. And that's, I think, you know, I think that's just as much a talent as the actual acting, frankly, is like picking the right roles when you're at that level of work.
Absolutely.
You could almost make that case for Nicole Kidman at this point, too, you know? And I think she's done a brilliant job of curating her own career and picking roles.
I almost even think she's even underrated, even though she's
totally
got all the acclaim. But you know,
I totally
it's because
think
of the
underrated.
Star power thing, and maybe
I
the
totally,
whole Tom Cruise phrase.
Because she's pretty, you know.
Yeah, she's got it, man.
I totally agree with you, and I think she is underrated. And I think we need to. I think she deserves mention alongside Meryl Streep and Viola Davis and the Pantheon. You know, she's right up there.
Yeah. What do you think makes Meryl and Viola so great? I know we're talking about how it's hard to define, but.
But they, I guess it's like they do the work, you know? Yeah. I think it's a lack of vanity. Mm-hmm. I mean, I certainly think if you think of Viola and like the work that she's done, I mean, that there's that scene that they keep playing from Fences that she won the Oscar for, where
not flying
exactly, yeah. And it's like, oh my God, she was so willing to just erase everything. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, you know, something Dustin Hoffman told me when I interviewed him was that you're not ever playing a character; you have to play what's inside yourself.
It's in the book.
It's in my book.
You have to find he has to find the Dustin Hoffman.
Exactly. And he used some colorful language, but you'll have to buy the book to find out what he said. But, you know, I think so whatever they're doing, they're drawing on reserves within themselves that aren't always pretty. You know, they're not pretty. They're not something that any of us would want to share with the world.
Yeah.
And so for that reason, I really do think it's very brave. Yeah. I'm very.
I'm in awe of it constantly.
I am too, and I've been. I think as I've gotten older, I am much less glib about putting down a performance. Certainly not putting down an actor, because it's sort of like whatever they're doing, it's a heck of a lot braver than what I do every day.
Right,
and
yeah.
The director Rick Linklater told me was, when I see a bad performance in a film, I don't think it's a bad performance. I think that's a bad. Somebody cast the wrong actor, you know, so it was a bad fit.
Yeah.
But he never blames the actor. And so I think I'm kind of coming around to that point of view as well, because these people make themselves so vulnerable.
I know. And the camera's just right in their face
yeah.
to be judged by the
God,
world.
Could you imagine? I mean, it would just be torture.
Do you have some famous or favorite roles? I mean, immediately, you mentioned Raging Bull. I always think of De Niro pounding that wall. Why, in Raging Bull? But actually, speaking of that, you know, that role particularly, how he, you know, was a chiseled fighter and then put on all the pounds, you know, that's become almost like an Oscar thing you talk
exactly.
about in the book, too.
It's
almost like
kind of
a cheat. And not in that role, by any means.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
you know, like the whole transformative
yes,
body.
The physical
kind of
transformation meme. You know, I mean, it's become.
Noticed a little with like Eddie Redmayne, Danish Girl stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
It's become like a thing, almost like a crutch, where it's like I want voters to see through it a little bit, you know?
I totally agree with you. And I think it's become. Well, and one reason is that, you know, and it might have started with Raging Bull, because he just got so much attention for that. And it was a good. It got a lot of attention for the movie, so then it's kind of like, well, it's a marketing hook, so it's an awards bait thing, but it also gives journalists, you know, like when they send us on these junkets, which I hate, but you know, when you're in there with an actor, you know, like we were just saying, it's so hard to quantify this process.
It gives you something to talk about.
It gives you something to talk about, like, well, what did you eat? You know, like how much weight did you gain? I mean, it's something. It's like a hook that gives people something to hang on. But I do think it's become way overused, and definitely it's become way over, rewarded at awards time. I mean, I don't like to see that.
I'm with you. In the worst possible way was like Suicide Squad with Jared Leto. All these stories of how he did this Joker, and then he's hardly in the movie.
Exactly.
It's just, that's like, I think it's that's
buzz.
When it's Runaway. Yeah,
yep.
absolutely.
Yep. Yep.
What else about from acting before we move on? Oh, you had the good Spencer Tracy line in there about how he's so modest. He's like, all I do is show up on time and don't bump into the furniture.
I know, but you know, but then as I say, the book is like, that's probably an act. You know?
Yeah,
I think that studied indifference was probably,
right.
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you know, it's funny because we do give Brando credit for ushering in the age of the method and this new naturalism and this kind of unstudied spontaneity. But people like Spencer Tracy and Henry Fonda were doing it even before that, you know?
True.
So, I mean, there was this sort of classical era of screen acting in the 30s and the 40s. But even in the 40s, we saw that breaking down and that kind of proscenium arch performance becoming much more intimate and much more natural with people like Fonda and Tracy.
So Fonda, Tracy, any other actors from that era? And then I guess
I love them all. I mean, that's my time. Like, you know, I mean, one of my all-time favorite actors is Frederick March.
Oh, my God. Best years of our lives.
Exactly. And
when he comes home and he hugs his all.
That's the scene.
Is it Myrna Loy?
Yes.
Oh, my God. And the kids are. And I just get goosebumps thinking
I do, too. And then just watching it from her back, you don't even see her face. And the way she tenses up and then she just lets go. And it just breaks me down every time. It is a magnificent movie. And it's, I think,
is that a William Wyler coaching?
Yes, it's William
but I mean,
Wyler.
Is that him coaching him to her to tense up, or do you think that's her? I mean, we'll never know.
Good question. I mean, whew. I didn't go into, you know, like that would be a really good thing to research, because, you know, I would like to think it was her instincts.
It's powerful.
It's a magnificent piece of, it's a great exercise in everything I talk about in the book. Yeah. You know, just beautiful everything.
Yeah. But anyway, performances. Yeah. Frederick March.
Yeah. So Frederick March. You know, I'm another one that I think is greatly underrated is Judy Holliday. You know, unfortunately, I didn't really get a chance to write very much about her in the book, but she's one of my favorites from that era. And she's known as this. You know, on the Solid Gold Cadillac It Should Happen to You with Jack Lemmon. Mm-hmm. I mean, she got this persona as a ditzy blonde.
Right.
She was brilliant. I mean, she was in real life. She was absolutely brilliant. And politically really sophisticated and fascinating and progressive and feminist. And she was the one, she played the wife, the accused wife in Adam's Rib, Tracy Hepburn. But I just think she's a very underrated actress. She was just a brilliant, you know, Born Yesterday, of course, makes me think of William Holden, who's another one of my favorite. Yeah, I could just
Adam's
spend all
Rib,
day.
We think of Katherine Hepburn. And
of course.
Oh, my God.
But
what about from, let's say, the more Hollywood Renaissance era? You mentioned Meryl. You mentioned
Kaufman. Sure. I mean, I think, who am I? I still kind of hold out hope for... I want Johnny Depp to kind of prove it again, like what a great actor. I mean, I still think there's a really good, you know who I think is a really underrated, you know, along with Nicole Kidman, is Tom Cruise.
Yes,
I agree.
He gets written off as some action hero, but he's a talented actor.
He brings it. He really brings it. And I do call out his amazing, he did have a breakout performance in Magnolia. Because I think
PTA
that was
Anderson, man.
PTA, you know, but it was like so dark.
Yeah.
And scary dark.
Yeah.
And it was like, whoa, this Sonny, suddenly the boy next door has layers. And what he did, I quote an acting coach in the book named Larry Moss, who talks a lot about the eyes. Like he says, it's all, and you can tell a great performance by what's going on in somebody's eyes. And if you look at Tom Cruise's eyes all the way through that movie, I mean, you could almost isolate just his eyes.
Right.
And you're seeing absolute just transformation, right? You know, I mean, it's in the moment. It's incredible. And I still think he has that gift. Yeah. I really, really do. And he might do some stinkers here and there, but I mean, I think even in a very underrated movie called Edge of Tomorrow that came out a few years ago,
Live, Die, Repeat.
He gave a great performance in that movie because he was doing so many different iterations of his own persona.
Right.
Very meta and really clever and very smart on his part. And like, he didn't get any love for that. So
it was like a sci-fi action version of Groundhog Day. You know,
he
just started over.
Yeah,
and
I mean, if anybody, that's one of my, I just wrote it down the other day because I just think that was so criminally underseen and it's a really good movie.
Let's hold it up more often.
I think we should.
All right, so Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman.
Yeah,
Johnny Depp.
I don't know. I could go on and on. Daniel, you know.
Seems like you like Clooney a lot in the book.
Oh, I do love Clooney. Yeah. And we were talking, yes, I really do. You know, I write a lot about the movie with Michael Clayton that he did in 2007 because I still think, to me, that is sort of the paragon of the kind of movie that I personally love to see, and I want to see more of. It was so sophisticated, again, brilliantly written, wonderfully directed by Tony Gilroy, also the writer, who, when casting Clooney, he just fit that role so brilliantly well, and then he cast around him so well. So he found Sidney Pollack to kind of bully him, you know? Yeah. And it was, as he said to me, it's very difficult to find someone who can sort of stand up to Clooney believably, and Sidney Pollack could, and Clooney was really intimidated by him. Who wouldn't be? Because because in a way, the movie's an homage to the kind of movies that Pollack used to make.
Of course.
So they were all just like, look, geeking out, you know. And
rest in peace.
May he, very much so. So
Is he our Cary Grant? Is George Clooney our Cary Grant?
Yeah,
or what
probably.
Would be the
I
everyone
think that
says
would
Tom
be.
Hanks, Jimmy Stewart, but
And that's another underrated Tom Hanks. Yeah, I think he would be our Cary Grant.
Just a fun game to play.
I know. But, you know, and he's a very interesting director. He's got a new movie coming out, which I'm hoping to see up at Toronto, from a Coen Brothers script that I'm really rooting for because I think he's a really interesting guy. I mean, I think he's trying to make the movies that he's very much in that wheelhouse of trying to sort of rescue that mid-range, adult-oriented, sophisticated movie.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. Good on him. Hopefully he does. All right, Godspeed. We got to move on if we're going to get through the other chapters. Production design.
Yeah.
You do a lot of shout outs, and rightfully so, to Stanley Kubrick, you know, The Shining. I mean, you can't imagine without the Overlook Hotel. And then, let's say, for a modern director, Wes Anderson.
Grand Budapest. Absolutely. Yeah. Of course. Well,
explain sort of to our listeners what goes into production design. And I know this is where it starts getting blurry with, because we're going to talk mise-en-scene and stuff, but it's getting blurry between what the filmmaker is, the director has done, and what the production design. But explain how good production design can be these more theatrical things like we're talking about with Wes Anderson and Kubrick, or also just a naturalistic recreation.
Right. I mean, and what production design is the world. It's really building that world, literally building a world on screen that you're going to be in for the next couple of hours. And so they can be approaching it from a very stylized point of view, like Wes Anderson and Kubrick. Or they might want to just make it a little bit more less theatrical and more naturalistic. And so both are good, and they can be delight. I love them all, as long as they're consistent with what they're trying to, with the story they're telling. And it's not by mistake that they're,
Right.
One of my favorite interviews I did for the book was with Janine Oppelwall, she's really known for her period work. She did the production designs for L.A. Confidential and for Catch Me If You Can, which is like really, really fun. But then
juicy movies.
Really fun movie, like retro in all the best senses of the word, but not kitschy. Right. I mean, I noticed the other day I was watching Wonder Boys, which is one of my favorite movies. Yeah, very underrated. And she did that, which is it's not retro. I mean, it's a little bit, it's 80s, I suppose. Right. But it's not self-consciously retro. Yeah. So she was explaining how, we were talking about detail and kind of the level of detail that you want to get into a background shot. And the way that she explained it was that oftentimes, the design is telling part of the story. In other words, it's providing that exposition or relating information that we don't want to hear in a speech,
Right.
It's another kind of easy thing to talk about is the level of detail and all the research that somebody went into making a historical movie. But she said, it's because if I'm not bringing all my very best work, I'm not setting a good standard for everybody else that's going to come after, because the production designers are usually there first because they're building the sets.
Yeah.
So she's like, it's my job to kind of establish the work ethic for the entire shoot, which I thought was a really interesting way to put it. But, again, like the best of movie making, often it fades into the background and you're not noticing it because you're not meant to notice it. But somebody's gone to a lot of trouble to make sure you don't notice it.
But that's what I want, and if any listeners are listening to this, that's one of the things I want them to take away. And one of the reasons why I like, just my personal taste, movies that are a little patient, where you can scan the whole image.
Oh, yeah.
That's one of the arguments against cutting all around, and we'll get to editing in a little bit. But just let it breathe so you actually can scan the background for some of these more maybe symbolic things like you're talking about that are providing details and exposition without the dialogue.
Exactly. And, and that's why the production designer and the cinematographer they're such a crucial team because, like you said, once you have that production design, then you need the cinematographer to be able to take it in a way that's good.
Or have the deep focus so you can see the background.
Yes, and we can talk about, we can either talk about All the President's Men now, or we can talk about it because that's...
Well, let's transition slightly into cinematography because we're talking about, so the production design is, setting everything in the background and everything, but... Now we're transitioning to cinematography.
Yes. And so, of course, that's literally the photography. Yeah. That's the camera work of the movie. That's the images that we're seeing are captured by the cinematographer.
But you mentioned All the President's Men. So
what were you going to say? And the reason that's such an interesting example is because that is a case where, other than the exteriors, they filmed that on a lot in L.A. So they came to D.C., looked at the Post newsroom, took all the measurements, took all the photographs, and literally recreated it.
They take trash out of the...
And they sent... Yeah, that's always been the legend. That they mailed the actual reporters trash from their trash cans to L.A. And that was what Jeanine was talking about when I asked her. It's like, isn't that a bit much? She's like, actually, no.
All the details.
But when you watch it, they photographed it. It was photographed by the great Gordon Willis, who's best known for The Godfather. He's
Prince
best
of
known
Darkness.
as the Prince of Darkness because he's so good with low light. But those newsroom shots are very high. They're very highlighted.
Overhead fluorescent.
Yeah, that fluorescent stuff. So he.
But explain, that makes sense because it's the place of enlightenment, the newsroom.
Exactly. And there are lots of, you know, and then you've got the wonderful, you know, parking garage dark scenes. But in those newsroom scenes, there are a couple of really iconic moments when Redford, as Bob Woodward, is on the phone. And, you know, what is more boring in a movie than a guy on the phone, right?
But pictures of people talking.
Exactly. But because of that incredibly alive production design and the background players and the activity of the newsroom, and Willis's choice to kind of photograph it all in deep focus, meaning everything's in detail.
Right. So you're watching middle ground, background.
Yeah, you're watching Redford, but you're also watching the people in the background. They're in equal focus to him. And then just incrementally he pulls into a close up. So that even though you're not aware of the camera moving, it is moving, and it's creating tension that, again, you're not aware of.
It's
but
so gradual.
You find yourself kind of getting keyed up.
Yeah.
And that's how a production design and a camera person work together. And, of course, that's all under the artistic vision of the director who's making those, you know, those final calls. But
did he
it's
use
just
a split
brilliant.
Diopter for some of that?
Okay, yes, he does. He uses a split. It's a way of getting deep focus, which it's a certain kind of lens that it's literally kind of like half and half.
Right.
So half of the shot is in focus in the background, half is in focus in the foreground, and they used, again, the production design, they used the pillars of the room to hide the dividing line.
And De Palma used the split diopter.
That's right, he did. Yeah.
But you don't need the split diopter. We got to talk about the legendary example of the deep focus, right?
Course.
Greg Tolan, cinematographer for he actually shared a title card with Orson Welles
Absolutely.
For Citizen Kane because it was that important. Explain that. I mean, a lot of our listeners might already know that one, but
But that is the great,
Grand example.
It is the grand example, and it's still worth watching to this day. But it is. It's that kind of use of the camera to. And it wasn't just deep focus with that. It was also angles and Dutch angles, you know,
cutting
what they call
the
Dutch
floor.
Angles. Exactly. and again, that was a collaboration with the production designer, Perry Ferguson, I think. I hope I'm getting that right. Now it's all a blur.
Right.
But just using that incredibly stylized photography to evoke Kane's evolution as a descending into whatever he descended into.
And these just aren't, I just want listeners to know, this isn't just some technical term, oh, that's in deep focus, why do I care? It actually affects, I mean, every shot has a symbolic idea
that's
in that movie.
True.
I mean, the fact that you can see the deep focus, I mean, what's the scene when he's signing over, I remember there, imagine, if you're listening to this, I'm going to try to paint a picture, imagine a deep focus with big long windows in the background. I think it's the scene when Orson Welles is signing over the rights to some of his papers. And the what's the guy, Leland? Is it
Yeah.
Is reading that you must relinquish a little bit of your newspapers. Orson starts walking and he gets really small in the background because he's feeling small. He's got to forfeit over his newspapers. Then he gets to a clause in the contract where he says, but wait, you will maintain, you know, rights to this amount of newspapers. And he turns around and he starts walking. He gets bigger back in the frame again. But that's, I mean, it's hard to explain over radio, but that's kind of where the deep focus comes in.
Absolutely. It's not for show. You know, I mean, it's all motivated, and it's not, you know, and the same could be said for camera movement. You know, that's another way that you can notice cinematography. So one of my favorite camera moves of all time for all of us is that great tracking shot in Goodfellas, you know, when
bing, bing, ding, ding, ding.
I know, when Henry Hill and Karen are going, he's taking her to the Copacabana, and you know, so much is communicated in that. It's showy and it's wonderful and you know, but it also works for that psychological moment because we're being seduced along with Karen. It's like we're with her in this kind of whirlwind.
Oh, he knows the doorman. Oh, he knows
the
chef.
I mean,
oh,
how could you not? It's irresistible, you know, to be kind of squired around by this guy. And what's so funny about that shot, which is so iconic and it's such a high point of that movie, is that it wasn't supposed to be. You know, he was originally supposed, they were just going to walk into the Copa. And then at the last minute, the Copa said, you can't use our front door. We don't want you to do that. And so he had to think on his feet.
Marty just comes up.
And Marty comes up with the most brilliant solution. And, you know, over the years, I guess we're segueing into directing now. But
Directing's in all of this.
It's
really.
In all of this. That's right. But you know, there are so many different descriptions of what directors do.
Yeah, yeah.
And much of it is solving problems. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like having a last-minute hiccup or a last-minute disaster. And then how do you get yourself out of this? And then often when they're really good right. or they're really lucky or they're both, it turns out right. to be something like that.
Or just leave it in there. I'm walking here. Oh, wait.
Exactly.
Leave it. Leave the car almost ran over them. Let's leave it in the movie.
Or like with Mike Nichols at the end right. of The Graduate, like, let's right. just leave that camera on them right. while they're... Right. While they go from laughing to this moment of complete ambivalence. And like, what if he had cut right. earlier? Then that yeah. movie would not have the meaning
exactly.
it does.
And I love that you mentioned, how have we gotten this far without The Graduate? Because we talked production design and everything. But
yes.
Ben, the opening of that movie, just like, if you guys want to know, just study like the first 10, 15 minutes of The Graduate and see what, you know, symbolic directing and
very
production
true.
Design. The bars on his wallpaper,
exactly.
you know, she tosses the key in the fish tank. There's
exactly.
So much going
and
on.
And just
in there.
The difference between his parents' house right. and Mrs. Robinson's house, it's all filled with jungle yeah. motifs and yeah, it's wonderful. It's a feast. It's a real tutorial.
It totally is.
Yeah.
And then I'm trying to think some other things because I'm going to get to editing in a minute because uh-huh. I mean, The Graduate has some of the great edits ever. Like,
yeah.
you know, up onto the pool raft and then
exactly.
Captain Mrs. Robinson. But before we leave cinematography, I do want to talk. You mentioned the Goodfellas single take. So I guess our listeners hopefully all know what the long single take is. He actually does it in Raging Bull too.
Yes.
They're back in the locker room.
Yes, he does.
And he follows them all the way out to the ring.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, he loves doing that. I mean, he's like, you know, the single take, it's basically when the camera just stays on a person or on there's no cuts. There's no... And the camera moves it's moving with the person. They call them tracking shots or dolly shots because it's sometimes on a dolly. Or sometimes it'll be on a steady cam, which is a camera that's attached by a harness to an operator.
Yeah.
But, you know...
Some movies like Birdman will do
it. Of course, Birdman experimented
with
rope. There's another wonderful movie called Russian Ark that takes you all the way through the Hermitage Museum.
Yeah.
In St. Petersburg, and that really, I think that really was one take. Some of the Birdman is a little bit of a cheat.
Rope was a little
bit of a cheat.
Damien Chazelle fessed up in the beginning of La La Land. They do the single, the quote unquote single take on the track. Damien fessed up to me and said there's two hidden masks.
I had heard that. Yeah, but it's great.
It's cool, and it's really wonderful
to see people swing for the rafters that way. Another one of my favorite. Uses of the single shot was Children of Men,
Alfonso
Cuarón. And again, you know, he was very adamant about the production design telling that story.
Yeah.
So he wanted those shots to be, to your point, he wanted them to be unbroken so you could take in that environment and that world and learn about what was going on that way rather than through dialogue.
That scene in the car when they're...
Exactly.
Oh now,
and that was also a lot of cheats.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but that's okay. I don't care.
He did a lot in Gravity as well.
Yeah.
He had a lot of them.
Of course, the
opening of Touch of Evil, right?
Of course.
With Orson Welles.
The granddaddy of them all.
Yeah, when following that car with
Weston
and Lee.
Yeah, and that's a crane shot and a track. I mean, that's like, yeah.
That's just because Orson Welles is
crazy.
Insane.
Yeah, but that's the kind of thing that, you know, film critics love, you know. But it's important, I think... I mean, I think we're all aware of, we love it and it's fun to watch, but then it's kind of, does it work for this movie? Is it really part of the storytelling or is it just that director showing off?
Right. You know? Are we just geeking out over the cinematic language?
Yeah.
Anything else camera-wise? Oh, Vertigo shot, you know, explain, before we leave, explain how Hitchcock.
The reverse dolly shot?
Yes. It's a push. So you're pushing the camera physically in one direction and zooming out, or vice versa. I think you can accomplish it.
I'm not even sure I can explain it.
But it makes it look like the image is detaching from it.
Exactly. It's like him falling away.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just another, it's another way that cinematography, you know, and another aspect of cinematography is aspect ratio. It's literally the shape of that image. Like we saw a movie this past summer called A Ghost Story, from David Lowery that used a really interesting squared off, I think it was 1.33 to 1, which is almost perfectly square image with rounded corners that made it look like a photograph in an album to get this sense of antiqueness.
Or even Saul, Son of Saul.
Son of Saul was
a
brilliant use.
So you couldn't see the Holocaust happening off to the side.
Right, it was all in blurry.
Yeah,
and I thought it worked really well. I thought it was actually just...
Or even Dunkirk.
And Dunkirk.
It really, I mean,
haven't
thought of a movie. That's one thing I guess we should give Nolan credit for is just average common folks on Facebook talking about, which are you going to go see it in this aspect ratio, you know?
It's cool.
Hey, let's give Dunkirk
He's
some
got
credit.
Him talking about it, as did PTA with The Master a few years ago. It's like, it's wonderful. I think it's great that these people, you know, I think it's wonderful. It's all good.
I think we've covered most of Sinner. Spike Lee, the double dolly.
And the double dolly, right. That's one of his signatures is when... A character will appear to be floating toward the camera usually, right. or like a lot. It's usually mm-hmm. toward the camera. And the camera's kind of moving along behind, in front of them. The most famous, I mean, I always think of Denzel Washington as Malcolm X when he's heading toward that, the Audubon Ballroom. But it's just one of Spike's little, you know, Spike has a lot of those signatures because he is very aware of the camera. He wants his movies to look like movies. He doesn't want them to look like TV.
Right.
So you'll see a lot of quick edits. We'll talk about editing in a minute, but he'll often do like a repeat. If people are coming together, like they're hugging or kissing, it's a very emotional moment. He'll do it twice,
right?
You know, and it's just like a little. It just like makes it more
thing.
Visually
yeah.
dynamic.
But that's what I love. Each of these directors have these signatures.
Yeah, they have
Spike
little...
does the double. Hitchcock always lots to circle around them
yeah.
a lot, and yeah, it's great.
It makes it fun.
Cinematography. Oh, filters. McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Didn't
absolutely.
They
absolutely
explain how they got that little haze over the?
Yeah,
image.
That was Vilmos Shigmund, and
yeah.
They used a bunch of different. I mean, lenses. Are hugely important. And lenses, I mean, and that is definitely something you shouldn't be thinking about when you're watching the movie.
Absolutely.
But it's something to think about after, you know, and McCabe and Mrs. Miller, they used foggers and filters to make it, give it that smoky, hazy look,
yeah.
which then became a signature of that era, of the 70s era, which a lot of people, especially like Sofia Coppola, loves to use that kind of
yeah.
hazy, filmy
yeah.
70s look. And a lot of people now, even if they're filming on digital with digital cameras, they'll use old lenses to give it that look. And the cameras are able to do that. Or they'll use sort of digital, they call them lookup. Barry Jenkins was explaining this to me, lookup numbers. But there are ways for people to kind of maintain that cinematic look, that kind of texture, that translucence that I think we all love about cinema and that
yeah.
we missed when the digital age started
because yeah.
it was so clear and sharp. It was just, it looked like a sports,
yeah.
it looked like the Super Bowl, you know?
It didn't look like our old movies.
It didn't look like
old.
A movie. And so I think it's wonderful when people are able to kind of marry old technology
right.
with new, but
offset
lenses
that a
are
bit.
Hugely, hugely important.
Yeah.
But, you know, honestly, for a garden variety, you know,
right.
movie critic or a movie goer, you don't need to be worrying about the lenses,
right.
but it's just something to be, if you like the way something looks,
then maybe research it a little bit.
Yeah, it could be because they used an interesting lens.
Right, right. Absolutely. All right. Well, moving on to the next chapter was editing. And you talk a lot about how, you know, sometimes, well, you can do it. You can have a great movie either way. But, you know, sometimes the best editing is the stylized stuff. And sometimes it's just the editing you don't notice.
Exactly.
Like there's what's the quote in the book about? I think you interviewed some editor and you say oftentimes the best edited movie of the year isn't even nominated because you don't notice.
That was Walter Murch, who's the best editor
right.
ever to live. Walter Murch, it was Francis Ford Coppola's editor. He was the man who wrestled that insane amount of footage from Apocalypse Now and created a movie from it. I mean...
Yeah,
it's a minor miracle that movie even exists
because
it was such a troubled production,
yeah.
and they shot so much film.
And I want to talk about that when we get to sound in a little bit.
Oh yeah, because he did the sound for that too.
But what are you saying about editing?
But Murch is a great editor, and yes, and he did say that to me. It was a wonderful quote. He said, "Yeah, the movie that should win the Oscar for best editing is the one that went from unreleasable to releasable thanks to an editor, and we'll never know what that one is."
Right.
I suspect that I have a feeling Suicide Squad might, even though I still think it was a mess, I think it probably was unreleasable, and it would have been unreleasable without the help of, I think Dan Gilroy actually was on that team, and he's a wonderful editor, and I have a feeling that...
You could tell that
you know,
would have had a lot of work done.
It was a mess. It was a mess, and the editing, they did all they could to make it coherent, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But sometimes on the flip side of that... there are moments when, let's say, the more obvious jarring—not necessarily jarring, but stylized—edits are the ones we love too. You mentioned, of course, the big Lawrence of Arabia, where they cut from the match to the sunrise, which was you said was in the script too, right?
Yes, you know that's an interesting thing because that edit is one of the most famous cuts in the history of film, and one of the most worshipped. You know, because it's just such a great evocative cut, so dramatic and emotional,
awesome,
and beautiful. But Lean was really obsessed with transitions. I mean, when he was writing, I mean, that was written by Robert Bolt, but Lean was, you know, obviously a part of it. And I think I have a better appreciation for this now too, that really, and Soderbergh has said this, that movies are really about transitions, and making sure that those are seamless and perfect. Mm-hmm. And so his So often his scripts would have those transitions written in.
At the end of each scene.
And it would, you know, and he really, he labored over that. I mean, he sweated that small stuff. But in the script, it was a dissolve.
Oh, wow.
And so it was Ann Coates, who's the editor of that movie, who made it a straight cut. And it just gives it such a jolt, and it gives it so much more power.
How could you have the... And then dissolve. You know, it just wouldn't cut so much stronger.
You could see it. I mean, I could see it in my mind's eye. Yeah, I get it. I get that that could have been done, but it wouldn't have been nearly as powerful. So she still gets the credit for that.
Awesome.
You know, she gets the credit for that edit. She's a great editor.
Absolutely. And then, of course, speaking of similar famous jump cuts, 2001.
Of course.
Throwing the bone up into the air and it becomes the spaceship.
Yeah, and that's what they call an associative cut. It's symbolic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Kubrick was a master at stuff like that. But, I mean, like I said, they're obvious in the best sense of the word because but the best, to Merch's point, you know, really the better ones are just the seamless edits. And when I interviewed editors over the years, like often what they would tell me is we're editing to disappear. We're editing so that you don't see our fingerprints, and we're editing for emotion. You know, what they want to do is keep the audience engaged and swept up, and they want to keep us emotionally involved. And so often a jagged, jarring, in your face smash cut is going to take you out of a movie.
Right.
So
you got to be careful with that.
Yeah, and you know, and generally, again, those aren't necessarily rewarded at awards time because you know, it's something like I'm pretty sure Spotlight got nominated, but I think of a Spotlight as being a quiet edited, you know, quietly edited film. That's not about fancy cuts and interesting symbolism, and you know,
but it just moves.
It was
you right
just
along.
Really good storytelling, and it kept us riveted the whole time, and so. Those are the movies I like to kind of lift up and celebrate a little bit and just remind people that it took a lot of work, you know, to make it seem so easy and so effortless and so seamless.
So for every psycho shower sequence or raging bull pummeling, you know.
Yes, exactly.
Thelma Schoonmaker, cuts,
yeah,
you know, they're great as well. But
yeah, they're showy.
Also lift up the
Yeah. And then it can get too much. Like I really I get a lot off my chest in this film, this book about Quantum of Solace, the Daniel Craig, James Bond movie.
The second Daniel Craig one,
right?
It was
so dreadfully over-edited. It was just, was a mishmash. It was just awful. And
sometimes you get lost when it's too much cutting around.
Yeah, it's almost assaultive. Yeah. You know, it's almost like they're pummeling you and they're trying to cover up, I think, for either a boring movie, you know, they're trying to make it more exciting and juice it up by...
Or some lack of storyboarding.
Exactly.
Let's just throw it all together.
Exactly. And you know, that's just it's a surefire sign that the director or whoever just is not in control of the material.
I find that with... You mentioned you get a lot of off your chest in the book. One of my favorite lines was... And I share this lament is how you're getting sick of the same old superhero movies. And you said I'd rather lay concrete in a 100-degree day than go to Comic-Con.
I know.
I'm sorry, guys. Because there's ones that break the mold. Wonder Woman, you know.
Of course. Great,
but it's just so much of the same all the time.
It's getting to be that way. And even Wonder Woman succumbed to it in that final half
hour.
You're like, okay, now we have to have the big CGI. You know,
you were so refreshing until that point. Why did you do it?
Yeah. We're all sick of it. Yeah, yeah. I mean,
But speaking in editing terms, it's like what you're saying. Mm-hmm. It's kind of that cutting around so fast we can't even see what's going on, which I thought Wonder Woman was an antidote to in a way.
It was. It was very much. That beginning battle scene was gorgeous.
It felt like you're watching moving strips of a comic.
I totally agree. Really pretty.
It was
pretty to watch. It was beautifully handled. It was beautifully cast. Mm-hmm. Getting back to casting and acting, not just Gal Gadot, but like Robin Wright. My God, you know. So I agree. It was really beautiful to watch. And you know, as much as sick as I am of the genre, I do give a lot of credit to the Avengers series for. I mean, even now, while I'm exhausted by these, I will be. I was charmed by the new Spider-Man. I thought it was really fun and funny. The high school material was utterly charming. Mm-hmm. And I thought he was great. Tom Holland and Michael Keaton, my God, that was a great performance. So
the twist.
Even when I say, even when I say I'm exhausted, then it's all in the writing. You know, like again, we get back to those fundamentals.
Yeah.
If it's well written and they cast it beautifully, and those Avengers films have been so well cast.
Yeah.
I think they've really... they've done a fantastic, generally. Yeah. You know, I've got, mm-hmm. there's a few misses in there, sure. but for the most part, I think they've been really good. So
good track record, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Editing. What are some of the other editing examples? Oh, Wild Bunch. There's almost
of course,
editing.
Yeah, Wild Bunch. And
you see,
Bonnie
you
and Clyde.
You see someone fall off his horse like three different times.
Yeah.
While, you know, it's just
yeah,
great.
That was that kind of new wave. I think that was at the time when, you know, and I know, and Bonnie and Clyde did that too. Sure. They experimented with editing as well. And they were all very turned on by the new wave.
Yeah.
And what was going on in France. And so they were infusing these sort of, you know, traditional genres, Westerns and action movies with those techniques. And so they weren't very period correct, you know, but they were correct to their own period, you know. And it was, of course, the Vietnam era too. So I think they were making comments about kind of, you know, unreliability and kind of indeterminacy.
Yeah.
I think those also come into play with that kind of jagged editing. But
they were totally into Breathless and all.
Yes,
I mean, that's where all that started. But
exactly.
I was talking with Ben Mankiewicz about how we were in agreement. That's the best era, I think.
70s.
Like about 67, which was the Pictures of the Revolution with Graduate. What was it? Graduate, Cool Hand Luke, Bonnie and Clyde, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, In the Heat of the Night, like all those movies.
Exactly.
To about, I don't know, 80 maybe? Raging Bull, maybe around there?
Yeah. I know. No, it was a great time. And I like the book definitely kind of hews to that. Like I'm very much interested in that kind of golden age because that's kind of, as I was growing up, my dad was a big fan of those films. They were still showing them on those, you know, TV matinees. So it was easy to catch up with them. And then that era too. Yeah, I'm with you.
Perfect. Absolutely. And it's not that great movies have stopped being made. It's just, I guess they're not as, the great artistic movies are no longer as mainstream as they were then. Like, it was the
probably
perfect
true.
Marriage of, like, The Graduate was the twilight of
exactly.
era. You know, like,
exactly.
It's like, how far have we fallen on the teen movie? Anyway, anyway, that transitions us into one of my favorite chapters. I didn't know it would be, but it turned out to be.
Which one?
The sound and music. Because
that was the one I was the least confident in.
You know what? But it was just so, it was so a delight to read. And, you know, it's because we're talking about this era, you know, how it's sort of capped by, you know, Apocalypse Now, too. So that's a good transition into this. But just think about at the beginning of that when you have the Doors, the music, the end playing, and then the fan is spinning to the sound of a helicopter, man. Just
that was all merch. It was he really is. I think he is a bona fide genius as a sound designer, as an editor, and as a thinker. He's just a great theorist. And at the end of the book, I have a lot of resources for people who might want to read more. And he's written just one of the great primers of all time in cinema called In the Blink of an Eye. Mm. And so if you want to learn more about all of this, you know, I learned at his feet. He was very generous with his time. I interviewed him twice. I interviewed him for the sound articles. A lot of these were based on articles I had done for the Post. So I had interviewed him for the sound article and for the editing article. And he's both times just been very, very generous. But yeah, he was the one who figured all of that out and kind of bent the sound. He kind of psychedelicized it, you know, made it very hallucinatory and weird, again, in order to get us into that weird hallucinatory world. So we know from the get that we're just in a completely bizarre, distorted state of mind. Yeah, we're in that boat, and it's not going to be anywhere near normal. Yeah.
Explain, you and I know this, but explain our listeners diegetic versus non-diegetic sound.
Oh, God. This is like, okay. Diegetic is the sound that is heard by the characters.
It's emanated from an on-screen source.
Correct.
Like a car radio.
The characters are listening, seeing, hearing it too.
Or a Victrola.
Non-diegetic is like music. You know, it's the scoring that we hear, but that the characters wouldn't be able to hear.
Right.
Yeah.
And sometimes, and I think your example is, let's say, diegetic. No Country for Old Men is when he's in the hotel, and
that's
the
great
hear
scene.
Anton Chigurh unscrew the light bulb.
Exactly. That's one of the great
happening.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is a great textbook case of sound design. And that whole movie really is a great exercise in sound design because it's so quiet.
In everything.
Yeah. It is. It is in everything. It is.
But,
it is. It's one of those sort of Yeah, you point. It's a technically perfect movie that I actually, though, to this day, don't really like very much.
Interesting.
Which we can get into later.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, that is a great example of how sound, just the sound of the wind blowing and footsteps, and that one scene in particular with the footsteps in the hallway and the light bulb. I mean, it just sets up this incredible tension. But the whole movie is that way.
Absolutely.
You know, it's just at one point I say that, like, if you can, sometime if you're at home and something comes up, I did this once with There Will Be Blood. I just turned the sound down and watched. Just to see, and it's like you can tell what's, you know, you don't really need the sound. And it's the same is true of the, you know, sometimes it might be interesting just to listen to the film, you know.
Right.
Especially like something with No Country. It's a wonderful art form.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think we're getting back to the comic book thing. Unfortunately, especially with the summer blockbusters, I think a lot of people have fallen into the louder is better, like, sound design equals loud, 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 clang, clang, clang. And
at some
point,
it's more is less. More is not always more.
Exactly.
Drowns it out after
exactly.
A while.
And there was a movie that came out last year, and I think it was, it might have been Doctor Strange. I can't remember which one, but it had such a delicate sound design, you know, for a comic book movie.
Right.
It was actually a very subtle sound design, and I was so gratified by that. And
really liked. I was so surprised by that movie.
Yeah, that Tilda was a
Swinton,
good one.
Everything. I was like, oh,
that
all
was
right.
a real good one. Yeah, exactly. And I'm pretty sure that is the one where I thought, oh, thank you for not just beating us over the head with these sound effects.
And on the other hand of that, I know we praised Christopher Nolan earlier for visuals.
Oh yeah.
But this is the thing he gets knocked on for
True.
A lot is, well, everyone talked about with they couldn't understand Bane sometimes, but even in Dunkirk, like, and explain why, because Nolan doesn't use ADR.
That's exactly right. He's a purist on many levels. Like, he still uses film, and he will not re-record his dialogue. He uses what they call production sound, which is what they get on the production day.
A lot of our listeners might not know that sound is even re-recorded.
Like, that's true.
ADR is,
yes,
they go back and re-record
ADR.
A lot
yes,
of the
dialogue. Additional
dialogue
recording. Yeah. And it's everybody does it. I mean, I don't know any. He's really the first filmmaker I've ever heard of that doesn't do it. I'm sure there are others.
Right.
But for these big mainstream movies, it's kind of shocking that he doesn't do it. I mean, for me, I noticed it the most with Inception. I mean, I still think that there are whole swaths, but I didn't mind it because I kind of felt like I got it.
Yeah.
Like, it was such a brilliant visual movie that I didn't miss the dialogue.
Right.
I did miss it in Interstellar.
Yeah.
I really did. There was just huge chunks of explanatory stuff that I missed, so I never did know what was going on. In Dunkirk,
I got lost in that movie, man.
Yeah,
Act Two problem we were talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly.
That
didn't
like,
work.
Where are we going with this?
Yeah,
thing?
It didn't work. Yeah. But the sound design didn't help.
Yeah.
And it's also a function of Zimmer. You know, he always works with Hans Zimmer, the composer, who's a great composer, but he makes these big, bass-heavy, booming scores for these movies that drown out. I mean, they just have a drowning out effect. Yeah. And so
tick,
it doesn't...
Tick, 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 tick.
And the ticking. Yeah, you used that with Inception for sure.
Dunkirk, too.
With Dunkirk, though, I actually...
Yeah.
I like Dunkirk. I mean, I didn't have a problem with the sound design on Dunkirk, because you heard the most crystalline dialogue in Dunkirk is with the Rylance character.
Yeah.
That's crystal clear.
There wasn't much dialogue anyway, so it worked.
No, and everything else, you didn't really need it. And especially with Tom Hardy in the pilot...
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't need it.
Yeah.
And I don't think you're meant to hear what he says. It's all done via that little microphone in his mask,
Absolutely.
And that's fine.
And one of my favorite terms, and then we'll move on to directing, Mickey Mousing.
Oh, I know.
I love this phrase.
Oh, that's my favorite term of art in movie lingo, and it's when the music follows the action on screen. So if you think of Mickey Mouse, you know, it comes from the cartoon world where it's like dee 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 when somebody's walking. And it's kind of you know, it's a no-no. It's like it's considered tacky and cheap and cheesy in a movie. What you want is for the score. Again, it's an issue of, it's like almost everything else.
Yeah.
Being on the nose and obvious. And then it gets into issues of should you notice the music or should you not notice the music.
Right.
Generally, you know, all the composers I've ever talked to will say, you know, I'm there to serve the story. I'm there to disappear. It's like the editors, you know, it's like, we don't want you to notice us. But then every once in a while, you know, you will notice this. I mean, like Michael Giacchino, my God, the music that he's doing for Pixar and all of his other things.
Like, Inside Out.
Oh, just it's like that, absolutely
that piano.
Spectacular.
Oh, it's good. Like I and up. Now, we're crying now behind the microphone.
I know. And he did he do War for the Planet of the Apes this summer? That was one of
maybe,
his, wasn't it?
But,
yeah,
man,
beautiful music.
Great movies too.
And
yeah.
Another one that always makes me cry is Carter Burwell. He does most of the Coen brothers. He does all of the Coen brothers and a lot of other things.
The car in Fargo when it first comes up, the
boom, 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 boom. I know, the timpanis.
Oh my God, so great.
Chills. I know. And then he also did the music for Carol, which I think was some of the most exquisite movie music. But yeah, scoring, I mean, I'm a music fan anyway. I mean, I grew up that, if anything, rather than a movie geek, I was a music geek. So I do tend to notice the music anyway, you know, just...
Which I don't really think is a bad thing all the time.
No.
You know?
Yeah. And frankly, I really liked Zimmer's score for The Thin Red Line. That was a really beautiful, beautiful score. So yeah, I do notice it. Yeah. But generally... You probably shouldn't, right. But I think it's always nice when it can exist on its own as right. a beautiful piece of music. I mean, that's just sort of a benefit.
Like Dr. Zhivago or something,
of
man.
Of course. I mean, those themes.
I love those sweeping scores.
Yeah, or even something like an American Beauty theme. You know, that turned out to be really iconic. Like, that turned out to be so lasting. It kind of defined an entire generation.
Listen to it, you see a bag floating through the wind.
Yes, I know. Which itself was a great steal from a wonderful filmmaker named Jem Cohen, who I write about in the book. He's a fantastic filmmaker.
I think you say also in the book that, what is it, Cinema Paradiso, that
Oh, that one always makes me cry.
Just makes you cry.
Yeah, even thinking about it can make me cry.
Well, how's that
Yeah,
one?
So those are fun. Yes, exactly. That's exactly how it goes.
Any other big favorite scores of everything ever? Or composers? Barnard Herman, Max Steiner.
Oh, of course.
Jerry Goldsmith, Chinatown.
Elmer Bernstein.
Elmer.
For Sweet Smell. That was a great score for Sweet Smell. Yeah, all those guys are fantastic.
Oh, Great Escape, but then also something like To Kill a Mockingbird. That
was
Bernstein.
Absolutely.
Corngold. Who did like Robin Hood?
Right, all the Newmans. I like all the Newmans, right up and including Randy.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, it's a great art form. And then you have, you know, you were talking about The Graduate, which kind of ushered in the soundtrack-driven movie, mm-hmm. which is music that is not necessarily scoring.
Right.
It's popular songs that are used, like you said, either as diegetic sound that the characters are listening to, or just a soundtrack to the movie. And I, you know, Scorsese being probably the master of that.
Yeah.
Again, something so very easily abused, and I think too often used as sort of a cheat.
Right.
To kind of,
I remember
you know,
you and Arch going 10 rounds over whether it worked in Baby Driver or not.
Yeah.
But that's an example of where it maybe sometimes it can be.
I think it wears out its welcome in Baby Driver, whereas he did not. I mean, I think where it really wears out its welcome is in something like Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
I just think it was way overused and overdone.
And a lot of these movies... Not necessarily in Baby Driver, but a lot, because I actually like Baby Driver,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of movies, it's just so obvious choices all the time.
Yes.
You know, it's like awesome playlist, but is it really that awesome? It's like
we know
those songs before they come on.
And I'm so sorry to report, have you seen the new Soderbergh yet?
I have not, no.
Because one of my very pet peeves, I think one of the songs I want to, well, there are two songs I want permanently
to
retire.
First. You go first.
The first is We Cannot Ever Hear Ever Again the original or any cover version of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, ever.
It's
done. Retire
it's a beautiful
it.
Song. We just,
beautiful song. That's why. I don't want to ever.
Yeah.
And the other one is Fortunate Son, the John Fogerty song.
Oh, yeah.
And unfortunately,
and
Soderbergh uses it in Logan Lucky.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I can't believe it. You too? Come on, man. It's so on the nose.
Mine for me is, if I see another end credits to Spirit in the Sky.
Oh, kill me now.
And again, great song when it came out.
I know.
It's just like some of these, it's like go to a different sound
there
library.
There are so many songs in the world. You know, a great, another offender.
B-sides.
Yeah, an offender this summer was Atomic Blonde. They used very obvious songs, you know, like
when they're running.
And, you know, Voices Carry during the bugging scene. It's like, okay, that's a little Mickey Mousey in the soundtrack department. As far as I'm concerned, but
but for all every one of those, we get you know a Scorsese that does weave it in well, or even I mean like Pulp Fiction,
Wonder Boys, like that's one of my all-time favorite soundtracks,
or American Graffiti. I mean that talks about a wall-to-wall
that was a lot of
soundtrack.
Fun.
Yeah,
you know another one I always have liked Noah Baumbach's soundtracks.
Yeah.
Ever since his very first movie, I remember thinking like, ooh, I like because you know it's a signifier of their
Mistress
taste.
Mistress America was that?
You know that probably did have a soundtrack.
I'm thinking
his first one was called Kicking and Screaming.
Mm-hmm.
And it just it had a great little soundtrack to it. Yeah. And he's always been, you can tell it's one of his, right. And as does PTA. He's a big music guy. I mean, you can go on this. We could just
so our word to the wise, be careful with the songs you pick here. Don't make them too on the nose.
Yeah, go search. I mean, God, it's all at their fingertips. You'd think they'd have more fun, you know, finding like cool, obscure, neat things.
You mentioned Graduate. We actually interviewed Art Garfunkel, and I asked him. I was asking him about The Graduate, and he said it was originally Mrs. Roosevelt.
That's right.
And they went on and on, and then Mike Nichols is like, "Have you guys thought to just change it to Mrs. Robinson?"
Right. Yeah, there is that. Yeah, so that's crazy. That whole movie is just nothing but great stories in terms of how it all came together.
Absolutely. Okay, I think we can move on from sound. Although, there's one more that I wanted to say. It was because you mentioned it in the book, and to me, it's where that diegetic and non-diegetic merges in Michael Corleone's head as he's debating
that's wonderful.
The train over his head.
Yes, absolutely.
He's waiting, and I mean, it could be
in
a
the
train
bathroom,
outside, but it could also just be in his head, you know.
Yeah, you're right.
Off the rails.
Oh, that is a very, right. That is a very cool moment when Michael Corleone is about ready to do his first, that's his first hit, right?
Yeah, it's the very first.
In the Italian restaurant.
McCluskey and Salazzo.
With McCluskey, with Sterling Hayden, right? Oh, my
Sterling.
God. Yes, and he's back in the bathroom stall, and you hear the subway. As you said, it could be a subway train.
Right.
But even if it is a subway train, he wouldn't be able to hear it.
Yeah, right.
Or I guess it would be an L.
Elevated.
Yeah.
So, that's what I always assume.
Yeah, you're right.
I think of like French Connection.
Of course,
Yeah.
It is a subway train or an L at that point. But still, it's so brought up, it's so punched up in the sound mix that it turns into his own conscience or his own kind of sense of dissociation. It's a great little piece of sound design.
Literally goes off the rails. And then also silence. From right after that, it's silent.
Yeah.
Or you mentioned Jaws about the two-note theme. But sometimes it's the quiet, and then as it comes in, you know?
Yeah, quiet is, maybe it's because I'm getting older, but I think I am more and more appreciative of just quiet and how that can create a lot of tension. I mean, there was, speaking of Clooney, he did a really, an interesting movie that unfortunately never really panned out for me, but it was called The American, about a hitman. I'm kind of over the whole hitman genre,
but
very quiet movie, you know, and it's like, I just think it's always interesting when filmmakers use silence.
Yeah, absolutely.
It shows a lot of confidence, and it's sort of an audacious move.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, let's move into directing then.
Yes.
Because, I can kind of see why you put it last in the book, because as we've already referenced a billion times in every other chapter here, I mean, it weaves into everything.
It does.
I mean, even like sound, I mean, you mentioned Blue Velvet, you know, how he dives, David Lynch dives on under the grass to the ants. But there, again, that's the director deciding a lot of this.
Exactly.
So, and we critics and viewers won't exactly know who decided what, because it's a collaborative process.
It is. It's the ultimate collaborative process. But at the end of the day, really, I do still believe that it is the director's. You know, the director is usually the person who's lived with the material the longest. They either wrote the script or they acquired the script and they cast the movie. That's a huge, if I heard it once, I heard it a million times of a director saying that casting is 90% of the job.
Yeah.
And then it's deciding on how to execute this script and do it in a way that is perfect. And so that's just about making all these decisions in terms of who to hire for those other departments, all those departments we just talked about, making sure that they're all on the same page and that they're creative and smart and have really good taste and will work really hard. And then it's to kind of police this thing and make sure that the tone is constantly under control. And tone,
all the yes-no decisions you talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I start with that little quote from the musical Nine. But Jason Reitman, who I interviewed, said the same thing. He said, I make 1,000 binary decisions a day. And, you know, maybe I make one wrong one, and that's okay, it'll slide. But then I make two. And then maybe I make more than that. And then all of a sudden, guess what? The movie's not working because I've let something go, or I just made the wrong call.
Yeah.
And Rick Linklater also sort of said the same thing. He said it's, you know, both he and Alexander Payne were like, it's really about tone. It's about establishing a tone.
Which is one of the hardest things for a critic to
exactly.
describe.
Exactly, exactly. But then when you think of the movies that we love the most, they're tonal master. Like Graduate is tone. That was
through
Mike Nichols understanding the tone of that piece and making and enforcing it all the way through visually, sonically, through everything, every detail was supporting that tone that he was striking. Mm-hmm. And if you think of why we love the people like the Coen brothers, and PTA and, mm-hmm. and the ones that were constantly going back, Catherine Bigelow, yeah. tone. It's that they really have a great, superb control of that. Yeah. And they also happen to have a great, superb control of the medium yeah. itself. Like they yeah. just, they know what they're doing. You know, they know cameras and they yeah. know lenses and yeah. they know all those esoteric things yeah. that...
And as much as I know, I kind of set it up as saying it is a collaborative process because that's sort of how the book's laid out. But I maybe it's the romantic in me, but I really want to believe in the auteur theory still too.
You sure, know? I know,
like,
I
coaching,
do too.
Coaching all the collaborative, yes, but you know, I do think that each person puts a stamp on it.
I think that
I could be idealistic.
No, I mean, I think even those, like, if you think of somebody like a Linklater or a Soderbergh. To me, they are kind of actively resisting that stamp
right.
thing. Like, they're so un-auteur-ish, you know,
right,
and they...
Is that
but
a word
even,
now?
But
it is
even
now.
That, but even that's almost a tour. Like,
the, right,
it's,
right.
The, it's that's the kind of journeyman Robert Wise, approach to directing. So that even in their lack of signature, that's their signature.
Yeah.
Is that they're serving the story. And that's, I think that's really, really cool. And it's something that yeah. we should honor. And that's their auteurist stamp.
Yes.
And so I am more likely to be with you than not. I mean, I think there are those directors out there who we probably don't even know their names because they're just kind of they don't really do much except just show up and they make the donuts and they go home. But
I always felt that kind of about Michael Curtiz, you know, like he made some great
absolutely.
Movies, Casablanca. I mean, he's made
Mildred Pierce goodness,
a bunch.
Yes.
But he never, I don't know, you know,
no,
it's, I know we're nitpicking at this point, but he never really had like a stamp to me.
No, and
know?
I think that's to his great credit.
Yeah,
and that's what they meant about serving the story yeah. and serving this, you know, like if you have a great script at that point, your job is really just to execute that script.
Right.
I mean, I think when we think of auteurs, we usually think of somebody who has written and directed, they've
right.
directed from the script
right.
that they wrote. So somebody like a Kenneth Lonergan.
Right. Woody Allen, right.
But like, Lonergan, he comes from the stage, so he's not a cinematic
right.
thinker.
Right.
So his movies, I think they have evolved a lot, even since You Can Count on Me, which really was kind of pictures of people talking, but
sure.
beautifully.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't want anything else. Like, it was perfectly fine as is. But I can sort of sense his embracing the medium a little bit more. I mean, it's just becoming a little more dynamic, a
right.
little more ambitious in terms of the camera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting to see where he's going to go with this.
Right.
But, no, but, I mean, there's a lot of really interesting... I'm pretty optimistic about the medium. You know, I think there really are some interesting artists coming up that are...
Who were some of them? I mean, you mentioned Bigelow. She's one of the best going. I mean,
yeah.
she proved it again with Detroit, 0-30.
Yeah,
I mean, Hurt Locker. I mean, you write about her a lot in the book.
Yes, I know. I'm a huge fan.
Yeah.
You know,
E.T.
Yeah, Paul Thomas Anderson is a great. In terms of younger people, I'm excited about David Lowery. I think he's really, really gifted. I think Dee Reese is very gifted. I haven't seen her new movie yet, but I'm excited about her. I'm thrilled about Ryan Coogler. I just watching him burst open
Fruitvale
so quickly
Station was
so gorgeous,
knocked me out. And
just
then even
so
Creed, I mean, where do you come at? How do you come up with this?
Creed was absolutely wonderful. I mean, and it gives you, like, even this summer, you know, we've seen so many good mains. Like, you know, usually critics like the little indies and the little art house things, but even mainstream movies have been really good, and Creed being a great example of that, or a Wonder Woman, or a War for the Planet of the Apes, or Dunkirk.
Mad Max Fury Road, or
you know,
these big movies that are actually have an interesting
they have an eye to them, and they have a sensibility, and they have an artistic, they're beautiful.
Detroit, you know, we're getting these summer movies that have some art tour stamps
Spider-Man.
On them a little bit. Yeah.
Spider-Man, you know,
true.
Lovely. So, no, I am pretty optimistic about it all.
Nice. You mentioned inside versus outside directors.
Oh, yeah.
That's, I think, an Anne Hornaday original.
I guess so. I don't know. I try.
I always say inside, a strong director, or I don't know.
Yeah,
transparent
I know.
Versus a strong, but
that's
but
a
they
good
could
one.
Be good either way. You know?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And I love both. But, like, an inside would be more like a Terrence Malick for me. Like, somebody who's so idiosyncratic, and they're making, it's, you know, it's personal to a fault almost. Like,
I'm
it's so deeply personal. Yeah.
I loved it up until about, I love Tree of Life too, but after that,
it's
song to song, I couldn't do it.
It's been a challenge. I think in
his case,
that's to a fault.
Yeah.
I think Kubrick was an inside director.
Totally.
So they're coming from a very strong, often very eccentric sensibility that they kind of make you come to them, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that it's great. I love that. I think it's audacious, and that's more in a tourist, yeah. you know. But then, and then you have the more outside, and I think of somebody like a Tom McCarthy. That's another
right.
person.
Spotlight.
Yeah, yeah, Spotlight, The Visitor, yeah. The station agent. He's not terribly interested. Right. You know, he wants, he's going to meet you halfway. You right. know, he's not going to be getting fancy, right. you know. I mean, but he's very right. thoughtful.
And like, would you put, like, William Wyler in that camp?
Yes.
Or Billy Wilder, maybe? Yeah. I mean, he had a little
sure.
bit more, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's like they're very, you know, maybe it's also kind of a, maybe it's the attitude toward the audience. Maybe yeah. that's what I'm getting at. You know, it's like they're very happy to meet you halfway and help you into their to their stories and their movies. Whereas like the Malicks of the world and even the Nolans, I think that's where Nolan's attitudes about
yeah.
sound design come in. It's like, no, you come to me.
Right.
Like, I'm not going to give
right.
you an inch. You
know, Hitchcock will be like, I'm going to show you something the characters aren't even seeing now.
Exactly.
Like, I'm going to let
you
into
this.
He's all
about the audience.
Yeah,
in yeah.
Rear Window, you have the example
exactly.
of that. Yeah.
Exactly.
Or even Psycho, like his camera will move over to the envelope of money. You know,
exactly.
He was very much in.
He's not being coy
no,
or being arty about, you know, and I think, as you can tell.
And in a way, that's arty. You know what
it
I mean?
Is,
I mean,
exactly.
Yeah,
that
yeah,
is
exactly.
part of his artistry.
Yeah,
and I appreciate that. Because I think over the years, you know, as I've been doing this more, I've become much more an advocate of the audience mm-hmm. and kind of like, look, you know,
yeah, exactly.
come on, man, you know, like, don't make it hard.
Right.
I mean,
you don't
I
have to spell it out, but at the same time, like, help us a little. Help
yeah,
us,
don't
guide
be,
us along a little
don't,
bit.
Don't yeah. alienate us, right. please. Just don't alienate us.
Yeah.
And I do feel that, you know, like, that is the trap that Malick's gotten into
yeah.
is that it's just, it's yeah. become so yeah. hermetic and so yeah. idiosyncratic that he's left yeah. us out.
And on the other side of the spectrum, I mean, We all love Spielberg, right? I mean, he's
sure,
one of the greatest
exactly.
of all time.
He's Mr. Audience, exactly.
Absolutely. So talk about someone that totally knows the audience.
That's exactly right.
But sometimes, like in your book, you mentioned Lincoln.
Yes, to a fault.
We should have left. It should have cut to black right when he was walking out of the White House. Right? We know he's going, hi, guys, I'm going to the theater. See you later, you know?
Boom, that would have been, we know. Yeah. Well, you know what?
You don't
funny.
Need to stick around and explain everything.
But I gently, because one only is gentle with Spielberg when you're offering some critiques because I asked him about that and I just
great.
Said, you know, it occurred to me that you could have just ended it, the, you know, yeah. when he left the gloves. And he said, I know, he said, I thought of that too, but I thought the audience needed to see, he felt the audience wanted or would want or would miss the scene in Ford's Theater if they didn't mm-hmm. get it. I think
but he didn't really give it to us anyway. He showed the son
yeah.
at the other theater or something.
True.
So anyway, yeah.
But you know what I wondered? That maybe he couldn't say. I wonder if that was more for the international audience.
Oh, maybe.
Who may not be as well versed in that night
yeah,
as we were. And
maybe.
So, you know, like, because everything now really yeah. is so much, they're yeah. so geared to that.
Yeah.
And maybe that was his diplomatic yeah. way of saying that.
Right. But still, I mean, whatever. We're just nitpicking.
But he is.
He's
no,
one
but
of
I mean,
the
I
greatest
think when I have
time.
An issue with
so
him,
great.
I think it does veer toward that he is a little too eager
right.
to kowtow to the audience.
Right.
And I won't even say pander because right. that's way right. too harsh.
And it served him
but
so well on so many other occasions
exactly.
that you get
and,
it.
And
yeah.
also, that's him.
Yeah.
That's his instinct. That's how he works. That's who he is as an artist. And you can love it or
right.
hate it, but I don't think you can't accuse him of being cynical.
I just think,
you know,
of, I mean, I think of Spielberg and I smile.
Just,
so
exactly.
how can you not? Yeah, I mean.
And I mean, and I used to be really kind of snippy about him.
Oh, really?
Because, yeah, because I thought so he was too
cynical. So you've a little on Spielberg over the years.
I've totally, yeah. now I just, and I mean, part of that is because I've had a yeah. chance to talk to him, and he
right.
is so much fun to interview. I don't know if you've ever had a chance to talk to him.
At the National like, Archives one time.
It is like a film class.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
he knows
it's like,
this stuff.
He knows, and he loves to talk about it.
Yeah.
And it's just wonderful. It's a wonderful
yeah.
experience. Him, Scorsese, Linklater, like those guys.
Yeah.
Just sitting with them and talking about movies is
well,
a
think
great
before
education.
Before every movie he watches, what, The Searchers and
yeah.
It's a Wonderful Life, I
probably.
Think? Or
yeah,
one
but you
of
see,
those.
That's what I don't
My
like.
My Guy Named Joe and
I know,
stuff
but you
like
see,
yeah.
it's the Wonderful Life part. It's his sentimentality
I
that
see.
I feel.
Oh, come on, I love Wonderful Life.
No,
right,
I know, but it's like that's the cynic in me.
Yeah, I see, yeah.
I can get, it gets a little much.
Right.
But over the years, I really do appreciate his gift. I mean, I think he is a filmmaker of just undeniable gifts.
What are some, and we don't have to dive too far into this, but I find that interesting, is that you've kind of warmed up to Spielberg. What were there, do you remember any points on your timeline of like certain movies? I mean,
well, you know.
Because Jaws was before you reviewed.
Yes, well, yeah. I didn't even
know,
I wasn't even reviewing for Schindler's List. I mean,
right.
I really, really loved Munich. I thought Munich
yeah.
was, I thought that kind of blew me away that it came from him.
Yeah.
Because it was, that was a tough movie. And I thought, oh, more, you know, he was growing. And Minority Report.
Underrated.
Totally. Right? Another Tom Cruise, by the way.
Yeah.
And I think that was the first time I interviewed him.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, I
and,
love it.
And I love Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah,
you know, because I was a big Robert Capa fan. And the fact that he was using, you know, using that as a reference, I thought was smart. He did it beautifully well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, and I think the way he's evolved has just been really interesting. And the way that he kind of addresses, when I interviewed him for Minority Report, I was saying how, you know, with Saving Private Ryan, he was kind of doing a 40s movie.
Right.
And then Minority Report was kind of noir, which was sort of a post-war style. And he was like, God, you know, that's right. Like, I'm flattering myself by saying, like, he agreed with me.
Yeah.
Like, oh, and you're brilliant.
Like he was sort of in that mindset.
But he was. And it was kind of like, you see it with War Horse. Like, he's constantly addressing the movies that have you know, raised him. And he's, like, addressing the art
Jones
form.
Indiana Jones is always 40s stuff.
But he's playing with it, and you know, you could even say that about Bridge of Spies, which I thought that was a really
great movie.
Wonderful movie. So,
anyone else? Well, long live Steven Spielberg.
Yes.
Yeah. But anyone else you've sort of changed or soured on?
Well, I guess most lately, I think Malick has been a disappointment. Yeah. You know, like I'm really hoping that he can pull it out. I'm hoping that, you know, he's done these three that have been his thing, and now let's see what else happens.
Phase,
let's see where you go from there. Let's see.
Or anyone that's grown on you
or grown on me as a director.
Yeah, that's hard. Statement.
You know, I would in the souring department. Quentin Tarantino, I think, has gotten a little bit tired. Although I was a Django fan, actually. I defended that. I thought it was a really interesting use of genre and an appropriate one.
You need someone to rein him in every now and then.
Sure,
you know?
Of course. Yeah. But I do think it gets a little bit, it gets a little glib and a little self-satisfied. And just a little, I just feel like it's tired, you know? I don't know. Now I'm going to be stuck.
You mentioned Bigelow a lot.
Of course.
Yeah.
And Kelly, I'm a big Kelly Reichardt fan. I think she has a real sensibility. Again, going back to that kind of like, she's willing to kind of slow things down a little bit.
Yeah.
And let us take in that environment. She's one of those directors that will let you do that.
Yeah.
She will. It's all about this environment and people in their environments. I love it when directors are confident enough to just do that. I'm a huge Tom McCarthy fan.
Yeah. Let's pose it this way, instead of filmmakers, because that's such a broad swath, but any movies that you have that have grown on you over the years?
Well,
that maybe
no
you,
country
that maybe
has
you
grown
panned
on me.
Or gave a mediocre, and then now you're like, you know what, I've seen that begin, and I...
Well, my famous, my most sort of ouch pan that I gave was for Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man.
Oh, yeah.
Because at the time, I just didn't get it. And I wrote my review and I was like, and then I went back and because my husband wanted to go see it. I was still in Austin.
Yeah.
And we went and I was like, oh my God, I totally missed the point of that movie. Like, I totally didn't get it. And
it
now
happens.
I love it.
It happens.
Do you have one?
I gave The Avengers 2.5 out of 4 when I first got out of grad school, and I was like, I should have been a little more nicer to that movie. Because
The Avengers, which one? The first one?
The original one. And everyone loved that movie, and I sort of felt the sting from our listeners. By
so the Joss Whedon one?
Yeah, everyone loved that movie. But so I've seen it again, and I'm like, okay, yeah, it was a little better. I'm just not a superhero guy, you know?
Exactly. And I think maybe it happens. And it's like, you know, you never know, you know.
Or what you just saw before or after, expectations.
Oh, so much of it, conditions,
you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I do think, like, No Country was so deified the minute it came out. And I think my problem with that movie, it has nothing to do with the filmmaking because the filmmaking is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, I think my problem is the source material. I think I'm just not a Cormac McCarthy girl because, you know, I didn't like The Counselor either, even though that's a completely different way to approach the material in an interesting way. But again, I just think it's this kind of mannered, macho BS that I do not buy. And no amount of that, it's kind of that same problem I have with Hemingway. It's almost like, you know, it's so self-serious and so quote-unquote literary, and that kind of laconic, withholding prose, I find, I don't, it doesn't do it for me.
Yeah.
So I think that's my problem. It's not necessarily the movie itself. So I've come to appreciate No Country a lot more just for the technical purity of it, you know?
No, I mean, I love No Country and Fargo and Lebowski. I mean, yeah, I mean, they,
yeah. Yeah, Lebowski, I still haven't warmed up to completely. Okay. Yeah, it's weird. Yeah. I don't know why.
Get on the dude train.
I'm not on the dude train. You know, because you know, that's one.
But that's one where I could see someone not liking. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
even
I do remember so well seeing that. I was in New York. I was still living in New York, and I saw it at the. I'm pretty sure it was at the Magno screening room, and it was so loud. It's a loud movie anyway.
Oh yeah.
With all the yelling, and it was. I just was. Pummeled by the end, and it was just like if I heard John Goodman, it just was so strident and so you know. And
it all
winds
up being like a wild goose chase, anyway.
I know, but I loved what it was love all of those old movies. I actually, Harper was on the other day, that old Paul Newman, you know, which is, you know, it's such an homage to those 70s. Mm-hmm. It's not just The Big Sleep, but it's like mostly the 70s.
Which you mentioned in your book, The Big Sleep, it frustrates me the more. That's one that I've kind of gone to. I mean, I'd still put it up in the great movie category, classics, but I sour on it a little because I'm like, where are we supposed to take from this?
Yeah.
They purposely convoluted it.
Style over substance.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Style in the name of style, and I just don't.
Although,
I don't have time.
Dorothy Malone in
the. I know. And it's kind of the same way with Lebowski. It's kind of like. I loved what it was getting at and the references, but I just found it obvious and strident, and I just didn't think it was as funny as everybody. But you know what? I'm going to keep trying because I can still be educated.
What was Ebert, like, panned Blue Velvet? I mean, everyone
did.
Had, yeah, everyone.
Oh, wow.
So wait, but here's a good point, because you're saying you're going to give it another shot. Mm-hmm. Didn't Pauline Kael say, I never watch a movie more than once?
See, I didn't know that.
I think
that.
I read that, and because I think she famously likes Slam Sound of Music. I can't, one of those movies. But the point I want to ask is, I do think it's worth seeing a movie more
Absolutely.
Than once, because I think sometimes knowing the ending, then you can better appreciate the breadcrumbs they were putting in
course.
There.
Oh, sure, of course. No, I think, yes, I agree with you.
Like Robert Altman movies especially, like Nashville, you're going to catch so much more of the characters in the background.
Oh,
you know,
it's wonderful. I mean, we all have those movies. You know, when people ask, I'm sure they ask you too, like, what are your favorite movies? And I always, it's a tough question because it changes all the time. But generally, they're there are those movies that come on, or if I'm channel surfing and it's on, I watch, you know. So that's going to be your All the President's Men, your Goodfellas, you know, your You Can Count on Me's.
Yeah. I'm a Godfather and a Vertigo guy.
Absolutely.
I love Vertigo.
See,
I'm
more of the Rear Window.
You're the Rear
Window. They divide you into two groups.
See,
like, you're either a Vertigo person or a Rear Window. I know, but I'm Rear Window.
Let's shatter that window in.
Okay, I know. But yeah,
no,
Vertigo.
Rear Window's amazing.
Yeah.
It is the textbook example of, it's self-reflective of watching movies, right? He's cutting from window to window.
It's about movies. Yeah.
So, man, we could go all day. But do you have any other favorites? I mean,
those are probably the top. Well, I mean, the best years of our lives. I mean, I think that's the one. It is very, it's criminal. Because people always talk about Casablanca from that age.
Well, it was the year of It's a Wonderful Life.
True.
And that's the one everyone talks about in the
holidays. Which, again, I find
come on,
a little too sappy.
All right.
So, please, I just want to make a plea for the best years of our lives. It needs to be mentioned more because it's a perfect movie.
And dealing with things today, PTSD, and
they cast ahead of its time.
What is it, Harold with the hooks for his hands? What's it, Harold Russell?
Yes, Harold Russell. Thank you. I want to see him. Yes, no, it was so ahead of its time and tough. It's a tough movie in many ways. But just also sentimental in the best sense. Like, you know, like oh my God, it just gets me every time. The wedding scene, it just gets me every, it's a perfect movie.
We can agree. Everyone go watch Best Years
Please
of Our Lives right
do.
Now. You Please. Won't be disappointed.
Very true.
3 hours will be gone and you'll say, whoa, that was felt like 20 minutes.
You'll want to do it all over again.
That's the thing with length too, and which we're coming up on 2 hours here.
Oh my God.
But movie length, I could talk to you all day, but I don't think length is ever an issue in a movie if it's well paced.
Exactly.
A 90-minute movie can feel like 3 hours.
That's right.
Or vice versa.
That's right. And that was another merchism. That's what Walter said to me. He said, I can't even do him justice. It's in the book. He has a great quote about that. Because he says, when you say that something is too long, what you're really saying is either I was confused, I was bored. Right. You know, I mean, that's not a length issue. That's an editing issue. That's because they didn't do what they needed to do to keep you engaged and oriented. Because I think a lot of times you drop out because you just, they've lost you,
well,
you know.
Lawrence of Arabia is 4 hours and I could just keep watching it.
Exactly.
Whereas, I don't know, Les Mis, I felt like forever to me. I don't know.
So,
I don't know. It's keep us interested. Keep us well-paced.
That's right.
And is there anything else we can talk about other than the book?
So much.
Again, it's called
probably
Talking Pictures, How to Watch Movies with Anne Hornaday. You've been way more than generous. We've literally talked for about 2 hours. But it's raining outside.
But it's like a good movie. It felt like 90 minutes.
It felt like 20 to me. So
Thank you. Thank you,
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Where can
it's
we
been great.
Pick it up?
You can pick the book up at Politics and Prose. You can pick it up at any of your favorite independent bookstores around your community, or you can always order it from good old Amazon.
Good old Amazon. Which, well, that's your company now, right?
Well, it's Bezos, we share a leader. Yes, we share the head of Amazon is the very benevolent owner of the Washington Post, but they're separate entities.
But hey, you're there with Marty Baron era. I mean,
I know.
Come on.
How lucky am I?
This is a new golden age of spotlight journalism.
It is truly the golden age of the Washington Post. Yeah. It's very exciting to be there right now.
And we're all lucky to have you there because, the institutional knowledge, but your taste and your sensibility and just your generosity of spirit. Like even reading the book, you can tell that you go out of your way to, like you were just saying, I've learned to not knock actors as much. You know, just things you've said during this conversation. You just have, there's heart behind what you do. So
thank you
so much.
I appreciate that, Jason.